Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're with RCR Greenwashed with Don and Jaspreet, and today we welcome back to the House Mark Cameron, the ACT MP and primary industry spokesman in many roles in the primary sector and regional New Zealand. So welcome back, Mark. Great to have you on our show. Lots going on in your portfolios. One that I'd like to pick up on is where we left off last time, is how is your members' bill moving on through? Is it getting any traction amongst your peers?
Don, Jaspreet, great to talk to you guys. Yes, the members' bill is going well. It's certainly got a lot of traction in terms of commentary in the House. I've spent quite a bit of time with my parliamentarian colleagues elucidating, illuminating, and discussing the very issues in and around my members' bill and the common sense that it brings back to lawn making. Just a bit of a capsule as to what the members' bill is seeking to do. It is to prohibit councils for putting veiled consent regimes in to do with climate change as part of their sign-off, you might say, with resource consents. Now, what we've noticed is many councils have, by virtue of trying to reduce emissions in their catchments, in their areas, in their geographical descriptions, put part of their consentable regime that thou shall not, paraphrasing if I may, do these activities if they have an emissions profile, of which you then have to determine. So my members' bill sought to be rid of that reality. Couple of things to note, Don and Jaspreet. We have a set of agreed national reduction targets. They are agreed. They're subject to debate, but they are agreed thus far at a central government level. We don't need councils to then go off on all this wokery about you must do this, you mustn't do that, and we're not going to consent you unless you know what your emissions numbers are. So the members' bill as a capsule is to prohibit that activity.
Yeah, and we can't, from my point of view, I hope it's successful, to be honest. We've got so many councils around New Zealand playing in this paddock and creating anxiety, actually, amongst their communities. And it's very disappointing.
Absolutely. And councils, I would just stress the point, Don, have to get back to their core business. That is protecting the rateable assets and the people that own them, affording an outcome so everyday New Zealanders can go about their daily lives with as little interference as possible. Councils have the old, and I'll frame it like this, have all the assets and none of the money. Mm-hmm. And yet they've got all design of interference when it comes to what everyday New Zealanders can do in their own backyard. I think a lot of council people around the country have gone down the rabbit hole of all things to do with climate change, and we can talk about fresh water. They have created their own interpretation of things like Te Mana Utawai when we're talking about fresh water, and invariably they have escaped or run away from their core mandate, their core business, and that is protecting the rateable assets and protecting the people that own them.
Fantastic, Mark. And sorry, we'll just hold the fresh water for a moment. From my experience, this regime that we're working under now has taken sort of 25 years almost to get to this peak. I call it abuse, actually. The rate impost is significant and growing far beyond the rate of inflation for the last 25 years. In fact, 2.5 to 3 times the rate of inflation is the number. And it seems that the power of general competence that was given into the Local Government Act in 2002 has given local councils the right to do whatever they like. And some people would say that's great. Get away from central planning. Go back to localism. But and I'd agree with that, but it just hasn't worked in many ways because they've become, their remit they've decided is far wider than the core business that you talk about.
I concur, and I would add to that, again, many that work inside council have gone down the rabbit hole of creating all manner of secondary legislation through regulation. And invariably, we have seen stifled activity, productivity at a regional level. And without over-litigating the point, councils have all the asset and none of the money. Central government's got all the money. And yet councils are behaving in such a way that they have almost centralised that reality, and by virtue are saying that we're going to create an outcome for our ratepayers, create an environment where they become almost godlike, and you can't do this and you can do that. And by the way, the ever-increasing burden on the ratepayer when it comes to the inordinate amount of money that they are spending with their rates or for their rates has just grown on pet projects that councils have adopted. We've got to go back to what is the problem, what are the costs, what are the benefits at a localised level, and councils should be doing their core mandate. And if the benefits don't outweigh the costs, we shouldn't be doing it. And the councils need to sort of use that kind of mentality when it comes to localised lawmaking.
Yeah, I agree. And somehow, you know, I much as I detest the term, Mark, social licence, because it's been used to pummel farmers so often, councils are now somewhere, I think, losing the social license. It's obvious in the fact that so many have had to beef up security of staffers, of officers. And this is not the New Zealand I knew 15 years ago. And if you see what's happening, their outrage amongst people, it is but obvious.
I agree. And without appearing overly philosophical, we've become something of a grievance society, if I may. And what I mean by that, everyone's got this appearance to object with everyone else. And a lot of that's predicated out of our officialdom and our officials. And I think officials across the board, I think they appear to imagine they're a little bit more important than they actually are. And their roles are not as important as they actually think they are. And they should get back to what is the cost and what are the benefits? And if we frame things like that in our mind, I think half the laws that everyday New Zealanders are affronted by would go away. And really and truly, we would go back to the 80s and 90s as a productive part of the Western democracy in the world, you might say, and go back to our core business of being a productive little nation, rather than a nation that constantly takes grievance with what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, so it's interesting how many people who want to have a say have no ownership, but they think they should have that say still. And we've got a lady that we interview from America, the American Stewards for Liberty, Margaret Byfield. She talks about you either own property or you are property. And I would say in our situation as owners of land, we are both. We are that appears to be the property of the regulator, and that's the problem. And I see your leaders pushing the RMA reform bill and property rights and that sort of thing. I think it can only be good for the stuff that you and I as farmers need and regional New Zealand need, actually.
Don, property rights are the core tenet of the ACT Party, and we've always advocated for the property starts with one's person and then radiates out to physical assets that that person may have chosen to invest in and purchase. We're a big party when it comes to protecting the rights of New Zealanders and their property rights by virtue of that. And erosion as a counterfactual is only bad for one's person and certainly the well-being of their assets. And we've fought tooth and nail to protect those property rights and get government out of the way of everyday New Zealand. There is a role for government. There is a role for local government, but it should be limited rather than this run-amok sort of lawmaking that we have seen after the previous lot and even more recently into the early 2000s, where we have seen this continuation of eroding property rights and by virtue productivity.
Yep, it's been a creeping syndrome, and we're paying the price in many in many facets of business around the country. So let's, we talked about, I mentioned earlier, the freshwater management plans of, the National Policy on Freshwater Management 2020. And why, when the Minister for the Environment, Penny Simmons, has informed councils they should be putting everything on pause with regard to that, it appears they're not. In some councils. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yes, sure, I do. If I may, we've got probably three or four councils that I can name off the top of my head where they have chosen to expedite an outcome regarding the NPSFM, which is the National Policy Statement for Freshwater 2020, even though the minister has, by virtue of her position, offered breathing space, you might say. Now, the reason for that is so many catchment groups, so many areas, so many regions have found the NPSFM 2020 incredibly corrosive for outcomes. Catchment groups, by virtue of the nuances that are afforded in them, are saying that the implementables that they're trying to achieve and some of the targets that have been set for, we might say, diffuse sediment discharge limits, et cetera, cannot be met. Nine on impossible to meet these appreciable targets that now have been adopted by certain councils. Segue Penny Simmons, who's the minister who's worked very, very hard to now afford the councils the breathing space, allow them a greater time to get draft proposal plans in so they don't rush. Invariably, some councils have said, flip the minister the bird and said, we're going to do it anyway because the law prescribes in 2020 legislation, which is now in effect, that we have to do it. Now, even though the minister has offered that, you might say, that caveat, which is just that you have a greater period of time for the implementation of this, allowing councils to get ready for the ultimately RMA reform that this government has proposed to do, they are rushing to get the 2020 implementables in place anyway. Invariably what's happening, Don and Jaspreet, is that we've got councils creating ridiculous frameworks that their people in their catchments cannot achieve. So the outcome is perverse. And I think there are certain officials that are embedded in certain councils that, for reasons inexplicable to me, have gone down this metaphorical rabbit hole of we've got to do all this stuff, even though our ratepayers can't achieve the targets that are designed therein. So real disappointing, and we've got to really put the pressure on the minister to enable or enact. There's a section in the RMA called 25A, and that would afford the minister the kind of flexibility where she could use tools at her disposal to stop councils from forcing through these draft plan freshwater changes.
Mm. They seem to have, if it's not coming one way, it's going to come another. You have land and water plans, which need other details. So it is the lack of clarity there, especially in a place like Southland, is stunning. And yep. They expect us to work through all of that, not to mention the weather and everything else that nature throws at us.
100%. And this is what I was so animated by. I wrote to the minister pleading with her to enact 25A of the resource management law that would then prohibit some of the, and from my words, not the exact wording, but certainly stifle this runaway, run amok council attitude towards implementables, which they're trying to pump through these draft proposal plans and now law changes that came into effect on the back of the NPS 2020. They have been told they don't need to do. They've been given greater leeway, greater breathing space, because all the councils know that REM changes are going to come in. Hopefully, by the middle of next year, we will have introduced to the House a complete reset of RMA to be debated, Councils are aware of this. They've been told they've got breathing space so that they don't have to force through these draft proposal plans, and then some of them are doing it anyway. And I just, I'd re-stress the point. It's putting huge burden, unnecessary burden, on the farmers of Southland, Canterbury and Otago, and we've got to stop it.
One last point on this is that the regional council here seems to be, or for instance, the levy body Dairy NZ seems to be saying, but you've still got to do your farm plans to comply. And of course, it sort of all ties up. It makes it look that you can't escape, no matter what the minister's saying and what you're saying, Mark, that the council here seems to be saying, oh, you're not going to get off the hook because you've got these farm plans that are mandated as well.
That is true. And freshwater farm plans, and I can think of, you know, those that are independently contracted, of people like Fonterra that that work in conjunction with the implementation of farm plans, local councils. Freshwater farm plans, you know, depending on which side of the fence you sit, some have actually liked, as in farmers have liked, the use of the tool, because at least that they can clarify their numbers in terms of what is acceptable, what is not. Others have had a more divergent view and said that the freshwater farm plan concept is quite erosive or corrosive of their normal farming activities. I think the wider point, Don, is just it's the ambiguity in so much of this stuff. And I would just add that when we, in terms of freshwater farm plans and or more importantly, our conversation around the MPS FM, when we have seen this hierarchy of obligations to do with Te Mana o Te Wai, goodness gracious knows what that means for most people when it comes to the mana or the life force of the water implementables, and the hierarchy of obligations that are found in Te Mana o Te Wai statements that only certain people are certified to sign off. Nebulous concepts like that are hurting farmers. So whether we debate the issues of what is good in terms of a freshwater farm plan or not, at the end of the day, it's this ambiguity that farmers are sick of, and bring on IRMA reform as soon as we can, is what I say. And just I'd tie off by saying one small addition, Penny Simmons at her disposal, and I relitigate the point, has a series of tools, including 25A of the Resource Management Act, enable and act it and stop these councils going down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Now, this news that has come over the last week, Mark, about the Alliance Group's meat tour closures in Timaru, that has certainly been hitting the headlines. Close to 600 jobs on the line there, which are gone, actually. And I'll read out part of the statement from ACT, where it is said, while we recognize that natural market forces have played a role in the challenges our farming communities face, it's clear that the sharp decline in stock numbers is a symptom of the previous government's relentless assault on Kiwi farmers. The confusion surrounding what we just discussed, freshwater regulations, significant natural areas, the absolute debacle of Hivaka Ekanoa, made it impossible for farmers to thrive. Would you like to expand on that? What are your thoughts about, I mean, have you read that one? But a lot of people, I think, seem to think that the assault on farming is just going to be restricted. The fallout is going to be restricted to the rural sector alone.
I have a divergent view, Jaspreet. The assault on rural New Zealand affects everyone.
Yeah.
If I could be so candid, people that think like that clearly don't know which side side of the planet the sun comes up. You know, at the end of the day, rural New Zealand is the fiscal backbone of this country. And we've now seen 600 people potentially losing their jobs. Certainly the depletion of local and community activity at the back of the Alliance network shutting down is a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy. We don't have heavy industry in New Zealand. We've got a farming sector, and it's damnably good at its job. And the farming sector, when you beat it up, you affect small communities, you affect provincial New Zealand. And invariably, the previous lot, as in the previous government, was really good at taking pot shots at rural New Zealand, metaphorical pot shots. And it did that because it didn't understand rural New Zealand. It didn't understand our challenges. And it would periodically, or probably more than periodically, let's change that, it would systematically go off and create laws that affected rural New Zealand in the absence of understanding outcomes. And by virtue, you can calculate what happens. We see rural activity in the regions decline, economic activity declines, and, you know, sadly, a closure of a meatworks, a slaughterhouse, is not a lot different from the shutting down of forestry mills or anything else. All of this lack of activity and employment hurts our regions, hurts our country, and hurts our economy. And it's a dark day when this happens. And I just wish the previous lot had actually understood the damage they were doing to my people in rural New Zealand, because I don't think they did.
And yeah, as a person who was farming through the first phase of rationalisation of the meat industry in the late 80s, 1980s, that is, when we had 75 odd million sheep, we've only watched the decline over that period through profitability. I mean, effectively, my generation bailed out the meat industry two or three times in the next 25 years to try and get it to a sort of level of logical capacity. And then we have an emissions trading scheme comes in and makes that capacity still look too much. And of course, if you're in the alliance group, I imagine if you've got an aging plant and you haven't perhaps had the resources to reinvigorate it, the first or oldest plant to fall off the list is going to be perhaps one like Smithfield, which is rough on the people of Timaru and the workers, but entirely predictable when you've got government policy destroying the reason for producing meat and wool, effectively. Dairying took over a large chunk of our areas as well, and we could talk about the attrition from that. But that capacity realignment through the meat industry was happening, and it's been happening since the 1980s, but it's only been made worse by the emissions trading scheme. I should have put that in one sentence. It took me a couple of minutes. There we are.
Bless you. I'd add to that, Don. I think there's a couple of things that we have to acknowledge. Natural market forces wax and wane. And I was very careful when I framed the press release up that you've referenced. I maintain that natural market forces and a trading nation like our own are hand in glove as a relationship. However, legislators that I work with have to go back to, you know, understanding what the problems are and what the solutions are, rather than the other way around. Legislators so often find solutions for problems that do not exist. Now, that happened previously under the previous lot. Former Minister O'Connor and some of his colleagues certainly framed what I would say political language that hurt rural New Zealand. They didn't go back to cost-benefit analysis. They didn't go back to what is the problems we're seeking to fix. And by virtue, the evangelical sermons that we saw out of Damien O'Connor's crew has punished rural New Zealand. David Parker is another one. Nice people in their own right, but gracious me, they don't understand farming and they don't understand rural people, and they have done a lot of damage to the confidence of farming folk, and I'm here to try and restore that.
Yeah, and you know, who thought that the special forestry test that they bought in that time, being one of the two countries in the world allowing 100% offsets by carbon forestry, was a great idea? When my husband and I were farming, within 4 years, we were surrounded on two sides by pines, both lots from overseas investors. And some of them, even till today, Mark, they have standing consents granted to them during the labor regime, which they can still use as they're going forward to keep buying up more land. And again, if it was purely market forces and some of these, I'd understand. But this was privilege granted by legislation. You know, New Zealand is open for pine forestry. And the chickens are just coming home to roost now. Sad as it is.
I agree. I mean, the emissions trading scheme, love it or loathe it, by virtue of it should have been a naturally market manipulated reality. In other words, what I mean by that, if we appreciate that we have an agreed set of national targets, and then all legislators stayed out of the way of the ETS and natural market forces determined the outcome, then arguably there'd be some investor certainty. But without being unkind, the previous government interfered with that natural market reality. Would what I would say pull artificial levers inside of the ETS and manipulate by virtue the desire or the pricing of carbon credits, and by virtue create an environment where you had this runaway investment in afforestation. Now, a couple of notable points. Some ministers in the previous government did try and recognised that the damage afforestation was doing, not in the productive wood sector, but certainly in the carbon farming sector. Former Minister Nash was cognizant of that. I had been in several conversations with him about how we've got to get back to basics, and that monoculture forestry was damaging rural New Zealand. It was damaging our environment, the acidification of soil, and really and truly, it was kicking can down the road. If we agree that carbon was stored in wood, invariably, at some point in the near future, the stuff with eyes are going to fall over, be milled, and the carbon was going to be released anyway. So it was hardly a perfect system. There were some changes, as you alluded, Jaspreet, to it used to be the forestry test, and then it became the benefit to New Zealand test.
Yeah.
It was arguably better than the special forestry test. At least it recognised, you know, some of the foreign investment that was coming into New Zealand for the sake of forestry, and what was the benefits to New Zealand. Now, interestingly, there's not that much afforestation in New Zealand for carbon farming from foreign investment. Overwhelmingly, the parcels that have gone in are domestic, and they are smaller parcels, but they, when you add them together, it's a lot of our land, and it's a real tragedy when it comes to hurting rural New Zealand. As you rightly point out, and we've just been talking about the shutting down of the Alliant Meatworks slaughterhouse in Timaru, this kind of market force and then artificial manipulation from governments hurts rural New Zealand, and we've seen it, certainly, in the shutting down of the meatworks.
And, you know, I recall going back 20-plus years, the people that were on side about the reason not to tax emissions from animals, you know, they hated it all. They hated the concept. They didn't like the likelihood of the emissions trading scheme in forestry. But over the ensuing, say, last 15 years, those farmers that have got those small parcels that you may, you know, they may have planted some trees in the gully or something, have just said, well, if you can't beat them, join them. And so we've got perhaps people that are amongst us who effectively turned on what they believed 20 years ago because they just saw the government wasn't changing tack. And so we need to just perhaps have time for one other discussion here, and that's around the confidence actually in the sector and the back off bank campaigns and the banking and by Groundswell and the banking inquiry. Clearly there's a confidence issue with farmers and their bankers. How do you see this playing out?
Well, thanks, Don, for the question. It's actually a good question. So there's been some real collegiality with my certain collective group of parliamentarians that I work alongside with in Primary Production Select Committee. We all agreed that farmer confidence was in decline, although there's been a bit of an upsurge more recently with the new government. A lot of the language that was being premised out of issues to do with farming and rural New Zealand, provincial New Zealand, was framed up on the back of poor banking, borrowing, lending, etc. The relationships with banks, all of this was coming up. We decided as the select committee to have what they call a briefing, and invariably that briefing has bled into an inquiry. Now, a lot of the lack of confidence. And we are yet to hear evidence, so I can't speak to it, too openly, because the evidence is yet to be heard. But a lot of the circumspect evidence that we've had thus far, some of the anecdotes that we've had thus far, is that there's been undue pressure by interest rates, disparities between urban and rural lending, disparities between being kept in overdraft unnecessarily rather than being leveraged against term loan. A lot of this language is coming up where there's been a lack of clarity in and around investment, certainly. And I'd add to that, Don, some farmers are saying to me, when they seek what they would say is secondary investment, their banks are requiring emissions profiling on said activity as a prerequisite or a precondition for signing off the loan. So a lot of that kind of language from the banks has created an environment where farming investors and those that are investing in rural New Zealand lack the clarity, the certainty, and the kind of relationship that we used to have with our banks. Mm. And sadly, the disparities between urban and rural, whether legitimate or not, is something that I am concerned about, my committee is concerned about, and we are certainly going to, you might say, hold the bankers' feet to the fire and find out just how legitimate these concerns are, because rural New Zealand has had a beat up from the legislators, and arguably they might have been getting run round the mill a bit with the bankers as well. So we'll find out just how legitimate that is.
Thanks, right. Mark. If I might sneak in just one, I know you need to get back. And looking at the weather behind you, that window market looks just as grey as it does out here in Southland. But Fonterra, recently they've posted this payout of close to $9, which if it eventuates will be the second highest. I do remember when the last highest was 2014, nearly a decade ago. And we suddenly have media whipping up a frenzy again. No one seems to talk about the fact that the Dairy NZ Econ Tracker states that the break-even price for farmers is currently $8.06. Now, it won't be for most, won't be for everyone. There'll be, others with lower interest rates. But everyone, especially the media, is at the forefront of still whipping up a frenzy about the fact that dairy farmers are creaming it. Do you feel you're creaming it in your day-to-day as a dairy farmer?
Oh, you're a nice lady. No, I'm certainly not creaming it. But what I would suggest, that there's probably three things that we have to discuss very, very quickly. Farmers have been arguably beaten up with all the inflationary pressures that all New Zealanders have. So inflation has certainly made life a lot more difficult than otherwise it should have been. And a lot of the extra money that you talk about us farmers earning has been eaten away by this inordinate amount of money that we're spending on things that we never used to. Yeah. Many of the on-farm costs have gone up by 40 or 50%. So that's certainly one thing. Then we could talk about the higher than normal, or recently anyway, interest rates that farmers have had, had to deal with. And that was something that I was certainly cognizant of, farming folk in general terms are cognizant of, and as I previously alluded to, some of the concerns around the disparities between interest that would be afforded to rural people versus urban. So that's the sort of second layer of the onion. And then, of course, the third layer is the overall nature of, until recently, the poor payouts that we were getting. So a culmination of all of that, and you can add to it the red tape out of the previous government, it was pretty miserable out there. And I think, what we've seen more recently, there's been a slight uptick in confidence. So the new government has come in, and in the last year, there's been some return of optimism in rural New Zealand because laws are predicated on cost-benefit analysis and outcome. So that's a good thing. We've seen the OCR go down. We've seen the official cash rate being adjusted. We thought it was going to be 25 basis points. It's gone down by 50. So there's some return to clear line of demarcation between fiscal and monetary policy. So getting back to what is the core business of the RBNZ, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. So it's doing its job, which is good. And we've seen some of the inflationary pressures and, subsequent interest rates come down as well. So all of this is boding reasonably well. Hopefully, hopefully that $8 isn't all eaten away. $9 isn't all eaten away, and some of those on-farm costs that are sitting in the $8 go back to the sevens and the sixes.
Right. Well, look, you've had 12 months almost since this parliament was formed. So, look, a lot has happened. Great to have you on our show. You have a tough taskmaster in Bryce McKenzie from Groundswell. When we had him on last week, he only gave you, surprisingly, the parliament, that is, the coalition, a 5 out of 10.
Oh!
And I thought, gee, I thought Bryce, that's a bit tough, but... Look, Mark, I think you'll take that on the chin. You're the authentic voice for farming in Parliament, and we thank you for that. And we thank you for coming back on RCR Greenwash this morning, and wish you well, and we'll get you back on in a month or two, perhaps.
Absolutely. Lovely to talk to you, good people. It's always a pleasure. And, I'm more than happy to try and put some common sense back in the room, and hopefully the legislators I work with listen to it. So... we'll do our best.
Thank you, Mark. Perfect. Go well.
Take care, guys. Good to see you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.